So the image assessment, well, you know, in reality, this will be about the resolution, which is a touchy subject, I guess. But I will just describe to you what I know about image assessment or the resolution. So to make it perfectly clear, these are not pieces of my work. This is just a general introduction to the subject, as soon as I can find it. Here we come. Okay. Hi, that's me. Okay, so I will start from the introduction to the correlation coefficient, which has many ties in the field to the assessment of resolution. So a correlation coefficient... That's...
Well done, put
okay.
Your hand on it. It gets bad feedback if you cover it.
Oh, yeah. No, I was trying to cut the feedback.
Yeah, no.
All right. Okay, maybe it was too low. Direct connection. Any case, correlation coefficient, also known as Pearson's R. This is a measure used in statistics quite routinely, and what it really expresses is a linear trend between two variables. So in this case, it's X and Y, and the definition is here. So what we have is the product between two variables. Here we have a subtraction of mean values, and it's normalized by standard deviations of both variables. So that's the definition. In order to apply it to images, we have to find a way to put X and Y in the same system of coordinates. So this is an illustration which shows you how one can imagine a correlation coefficient between two images. So normally we would use some kind of mask which just outlines the area within which the information is contained. Outside of the mask we have a background. The shape of the mask in this case doesn't matter. And we would pick up individual elements or pixels from the same location on both images. So let's say this one and this one, and put them on this axis. So let's say this one is 5 and this one will be 1, and between the two the coordinate of this point is here. And we can keep going through the mask, take the next pixel, this one is here, this one is here, and so on and so forth. So after exhausting all pixels, we would have a large number of points on these two-dimensional planes. And it's easy to notice that should two images be very similar, all these points would be on a line or close to it. So intuitively, it's quite clear what is happening. The more similar these two images, the closer to the line all these points would be. If the two images are not very similar, the points would be all over. All right? So that's a simple trick. So as I was saying, for images that are virtually identical, all points are on a line, and the value of correlation coefficient is high. Again, if we look at the equation very closely, we can realize that the values that this number, correlation coefficient, can have are between plus 1 and minus 1. So again, for images that are identical, have the same contrast, the value is close to 1, and this point is an unfortunate outlier. So what happens when we invert the contrast? Yes, one image is black on white on black background, the other way is inverted. Obviously, the correlation coefficient will be negative, because now whenever this image has a high value, this image has low value. Otherwise, they are identical. So again, large absolute value of correlation coefficient means that images are similar. If it happens to be negative, that means that there is a contrast inversion between them. Finally, if these two images have very little in common, the value of correlation coefficient will be low. Still, it's unlikely that it will be exactly zero or close to zero, because they still have something in common, meaning both are at the center of the image, both have the same contrast, so this slightly positive value means that they are at more or less the same location, although in general, still they have nothing in common. So, the interesting property of the correlation coefficient is that it indicates a proportion of the variability in two images that is accounted for by linear model. What it means is that what really counts is the square correlation coefficient, not its value, and that is a common mistake which is made. And here I have a table where I compare the value of the correlation coefficient with its square. So, for example, 0.71, the value of correlation coefficient, would appear to be high, but what that means is that only half of the variability between two images is shared. So it's not as much as it would appear. For correlation coefficient 0.5, which still, naively thinking, would be high, that means only a quarter of variability between these two images is accounted for by the linear model. Zero, of course, is zero. There is no linear relation between two images. It still doesn't mean that they are not similar. But for example, if I take an image and its square root, the correlation coefficient will be low, they will look very similar, but what it simply means that they are not related by a linear equation. Finally, minus one, perfectly, as you see, R square is still one, meaning they are identical, and simply the contrast is different. Now, looking by these correlation coefficients, obviously we would want to know slightly more about it, and that goes deeper into statistical analysis. Because whenever we encounter particular value, say 0.3, the obvious question that we would ask is, how far are we from zero? Can we say that this value is truly different from zero, or we just got it by chance? And that's how statisticians reason. By calculating the value of correlation coefficient or any statistical estimate, or say average variance, what is a chance that we could get this value by pure coincidence? All right? So obviously, by looking at the value itself, that is impossible to answer. What has to enter into this equation or the reasoning is number of points that were used to calculate that R. Obviously, if I go back, if two images have many, 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 many points in them, and the correlation coefficient is 0.3, it's a better value than the same 0.3, but obtained from two images that just had 5 pixels. So that's a general reasoning that is applied in statistics. And indeed, the same reasoning can be applied to correlation coefficient. The problem that we have with correlation coefficient is that, as I already said, its values are between plus one and minus one. That means that the distribution of these correlation coefficients that we would calculate between all possible images that we can think about would be very strange, because it's restricted between these two values. Statisticians generally like to think in terms of normal distribution, because if something has a normal distribution is this bell curve that you're certainly familiar with, then for estimators that happen to have normal distribution, it's easy to apply this reasoning, because it's very easy to calculate what are the areas under this bell curve. All right? So in order to apply this analysis to correlation coefficient, Fisher, who was a famous statistician, in 1921 derived a transformation that, when applied to correlation coefficient, yields a new number, which I have as z here, and this new number happens to have normal distribution. Is that clear? So we do this transformation, and now instead of talking about R, correlation coefficient, we can talk about Z, and Z, as I say here, happens to have a normal distribution with the variance given as 1, standard deviation given as 1 over square root square root of n minus 3, when n is this number of points that was in the image that were used to calculate the value of r. Okay? So now the equation is beautiful because the z has a normal distribution. We know what its standard deviation is, how broad this the distribution is depending on number of points. And now we can start worrying about the error. In a sense, now we can start thinking whether the value that we obtained is, as statisticians say, significant, which in simple words means what is the chance that we got it just by pure coincidence, and in fact there is no linear relation. Okay? So in statistics, this kind of reasoning is based on so-called type 1 errors. And this error we make when we reject a hypothesis when in fact it was true. Right? So the risk of this error, which is normally given as alpha, is called a significance level, and this is probably something that you're, to an extent, familiar with. So in our case, we would simply want to know whether correlation coefficient between two images is 0. We measured something, so it's 0.2, but our hypothesis that in fact it's 0, yes? And we are asking ourselves, if we reject this hypothesis that in fact it's 0, what is the risk that we will make a mistake, all right? So here I give an example. So I calculated correlation coefficient, and it happens to be 0.15, and I used 200 points, yes? So I can reject the hypothesis that this R is in fact 0, and it has simply value 0.15 because of errors in my measurement. So I can reject this hypothesis on a 5% significance level. All right? Meaning, now I'm saying, no, in fact, the correlation is significant. It is not 0.15 by chance. There is a linear relation by these two things, but I have to keep in mind that by saying so, I'm still taking a risk that 5 times out of 100, I'm making a mistake, and in fact, the correlation coefficient indeed is 0. All right. So, in statistics, what they say is that I can tolerate to be wrong 5 out of 100 times. As you see, there is certain arbitrariness attached to it, because the obvious question is, I simply shifted the burden of proof to somewhere else, because now what is arbitrary is this significance level. And when statistical analysis is used, what is a customary significance level varies from field to field. For example, engineers who build bridges would want to have this number very low. We wouldn't like bridges that collapse 5 times out of 100. In biology, interestingly, it is not unusual to see significance levels as high as 10%. Biologists tend to be much more forgiving. All right. So simply now the arbitrary choice is of the significance level, but at least when we communicate with somebody, we can we can understand each other. What is my tolerance towards errors? Otherwise, I would simply keep arguing that 0.7 is better than 0.3, but this statement is meaningless because I have to use this n number of points and simply say, okay, I like to be right at significance level of 1%. All right? So now, as I was saying, we agreed on this transformation. We know now that z has a normal distribution, and we can do something which often is done in physics, and probably you saw graphs like that. In a sense, I have a point, which is now my correlation coefficient, and I can try to do a plot which has something which is called error bars. Yes? And the way to obtain it is very simple. Since I know that z has a normal distribution, yes, and its standard deviation is 1 over square root of n, I can put a value of r here and the error bars on a certain significance level that I choose. Yes? So these error bars, for example, could be plus minus 1 standard deviation or 2 standard deviations or whatever I will choose. All right? So now the problem is that I can do these error bars for z, for the transformed variable, which has normal distribution, but I don't really know what these error bars are for the correlation coefficient, yes? But this is what I would want to know. I would want to know what are the error bars, what are the confidence intervals for a correlation coefficient. So a simple trick is I can use this transformation, calculate z. Now I know that z has an error plus minus this value, so I can calculate z plus 1 over square root of n, z minus square root of 1 over square root of n, and apply inverse transformation, which I put here in very small letters, and that will give me r plus my error bar and r minus error bar. This happens to be reasonable because although for z variable, these error bars are symmetric, obviously, yes, because say it will be z plus 0.1 and z minus 0.1. For the transformed variable, yes, since this transformation is nonlinear, these error bars are no longer symmetric. And that is simply a reflection of the fact that the correlation coefficient is bound by plus minus 1. So obviously the upper error bar cannot be larger than 1. Okay, I hope that is clear, and why it's relevant will be clear very soon. So we can go further. Very often we are interested in the value of correlation coefficient at zero. And using the previous reasoning, all of that can be simplified further, and it turns out that if we are worried about our correlation coefficient being zero, then R has approximately normal distribution, even without this complicated transformation, and its standard deviation is 1 over square root of n, where n is the number of points that I use to calculate correlation coefficient. And confidence limits, these error bars, are now simply 1 over square root over n. And in this case, if I test correlation coefficient for its value being zero, the error bars are symmetric around zero, yes, with plus minus 1 over square root of n. Okay, so if I, the message here is, if I'm worried about correlation coefficients being zero, then the reasoning is very simple, because at zero, correlation coefficient has approximately normal distribution. If I worry about correlation coefficient having value 0.5 or something, I have to use these very simple equations and draw error bars. So now, the standard deviation, say, is 1 over square root of n. But that gives me just one possible confidence limit. Which one should I choose? So again, I'm going back to my normal curve, and I can apply two possible reasonings. In physics, in engineering, we like to talk about standard deviations. Yes? In a sense, we would express this probability or significance level in terms of how far from the average I am in terms of standard deviation. Standard deviation is a nice thing because it simply expresses how broad this normal curve is. Also, it is easy to calculate how much area is included under this bell curve depending on the number of standard deviations that I'm away from the average. Yes? And since this curve is nothing else but the probability distribution of my correlation coefficient, I can simply calculate what is the probability of observing a correlation coefficient within certain standard deviation of what I have. So what is very well known in physics, in statistics, are these numbers. In a sense, that 68% of observations that have normal error fall within plus minus 1 sigma from the average. So if I increase my bar to 2 sigma, then I'm certain that already 95% of possible observations will be within this region. 3 sigma, I'm already at 99.7%, okay? That means that in practice, almost all observations will be within plus minus 3 standard deviations. If you want to test it, a very simple thing is to buy a ticket to Las Vegas and start playing, and you will see what is the chance of coming back rich. Indeed, most of our money will be spent on this 99.7%, which is close to the average, meaning loss to the player. Now, we can look at it the way statisticians do, and as I say, statisticians prefer to talk about significance level, and that's what we will see in many papers. And here, I simply compare significance level with standard deviation. So, as you see, 3 sigma corresponds to an error of more or less 2%. If we want to be very accurate, for example, 5 sigmas correspond to a really tiny error, and the likelihood of seeing something which is beyond 5 sigmas is negligible. So these are general properties of normal distribution. What does it have to do with the resolution? So far, not very much, but it so happens that correlation coefficient is directly related in image analysis to the signal content in the image. The test is very simple. We can compare 2 images and then observe that what they share can be expressed as a signal-to-noise ratio in these images, and this is related to the value of correlation coefficient that we measure. And how that works, I will explain in few next slides. So signal-to-noise ratio is defined as a power of signal to power of noise. That sounds very abstract, but in fact, in image processing, if we neglect the average of our images, which is of no interest because I hope you agree that in electron microscopy we don't really measure the average density due to the influence of the transfer function. So if we neglect the averages of these images, it simply happens that signal-to-noise ratio is a ratio of the variance of the signal, yes, how much the signal varies, what are the intensities in the image, to the variance of noise. So that's the definition. How does it relate to the correlation coefficient? Well, again, there is a very simple math that one can go through. So as I was showing, we can take these 2 masks, calculate correlation coefficient, and then assume that in each case, for each pixel, the image is composed of signal and some kind of noise. So signal is something that repeats itself between images. Noise is this random observation which is different from one pixel to another and different from one image to another. So now we assume that these images have something in common, this is our signal, S, and something that differs, and this we treat as noise. So then, looking at the definition of correlation coefficient and calculating how it will behave for variables X and Y, which are composed of these quantities, we can come out to a very simple relation, which appeared in Joachim's paper, I think already in the 70s, that correlation coefficient is related to signal-to-noise ratio through this simple equation. It's SNR divided by SNR plus 1. So again, that makes a lot of sense because, as I said, correlation coefficient is between minus and plus 1. Signal-to-noise ratio, come to think about it, if we look at the definition, can be from 0 to infinity. If noise is 0, if there is no noise, signal-to-noise ratio will be infinite. If there is no signal, on the other hand, signal-to-noise ratio will be 0. Now, for those of you who like playing with equation, you can inject these values here and relate signal-to-noise ratio in the image to values of correlation coefficient. Sorry, I think that I... Aha, so I have it here. So, for example, if there is no noise, if there is no signal, then signal-to-noise ratio will be 0. So I have 0 divided by 1 equals 0. Short. If there is no signal in the image, correlation coefficient will be zero. On the other hand, if SNR is very, very, very large, yes, then I have a large number divided by large number plus one, I can neglect one, correlation coefficient is one. All right? So these are two extreme situations. Moreover, I can simply invert this equation, and based on observed values of correlation coefficient, which is this rho here, I can calculate signal-to-noise ratio, and again, one can easily verify that if rho is equal 1, signal-to-noise ratio is infinity. For correlation coefficient 0, signal-to-noise ratio is 0. Please don't ask me what happens when correlation coefficient is minus 1. That doesn't work. Okay, so now very briefly, the properties. So as I said, it's a measure of linear relation, but that's what we worry about because our whole image formation process we consider to be linear, starting from the protein through through microscopy, scanning, image processing. All these steps are linear, and we believe that we maintain linear relation between the electron potential in the protein and our images. Yes, that's what we do. So that's a reasonable measure because, in general, correlation coefficient measures linear relations between two images. The values are between plus minus 1. What I neglected to say that it's invariant with respect to linear transformations. It sounds very complicated, but all what it means is that I can multiply my images by a number or add a number, and this value will remain the same. So it's a very good measure because even if I change the scaling of my data, the observed, the calculated correlation coefficient will remain the same. This is something which is good to remember, that what really matters is the square of correlation coefficient. No, it's not its value. Another thing which we should keep in mind, that for correlation coefficient equals 0, it has approximately normal distribution with standard deviation 1 over square root of n, and that in general we can use this Fisher's transformation and obtain a new value z, new number z, which has a normal distribution. And finally, what is very important, that in image analysis, there is relation between correlation coefficients and signal-to-noise ratio. Well, so the obvious question, I think I spent half an hour already talking about it, what does it have to do with resolution? Well, the simple answer is nothing. Yes? The reason is that the concept of resolution, as it's used in optics, electron optics, and many other fields, is based on completely different considerations, not on signal-to-noise ratio. It's based on a simple conceptual experiment in which we have two light sources, or whatever, and then we pass this light through our imaging system. So this could be the microscope. Obviously, because of distortions and imperfect lenses and many other problems, what we will observe here are not two point functions, delta function. There won't be simple sharp intensities, but instead they will be diffused and they will again have these, in most cases, Gaussian shape. All right? So now the concept of resolution is related to this simple experiment. Assuming that these are point sources, how broad these curves are, yes? If the system is, imaging system is very poor, these curves will be very broad. That means that if these points are too close, these two curves that I measure, that I observe in the microscope, will start overlapping. And if they are too close, at certain point, I will not be able to tell one from another or answer the question whether indeed these are two light sources or only one. And this is called resolving power of optical system, and this is what is understood by the resolution. So in 2D, it so happens that this can be expressed by these Airy functions, and again, this is just an illustration that we would see in 2D these kind of sharp functions with ringing, this ringing around. And again, if I start moving them closer and closer, at certain point they will fuse, and very often resolution is defined as a point at which maximum, first maximum of one function overlaps with the first minimum of the other one, and then we will say that we cannot resolve these points anymore. So what happens is that, again, I hope you agree that this is somewhat arbitrary, because this is just an agreement in optics that this is what I will consider a resolution, but it's not an absolute fact or an absolute definition. All right? So now, as far as electron microscopy goes, there are many resolution limiting factors. So again, we can think about our microscope in terms of this experiment that I described, and we can imagine that we put two gold particles on the grid, go through the whole process, and look at them on the grid. Obviously, they will be diffused, but I will still see them. It so happens that theoretical resolution of electron microscope is very high because it's related to wavelength of electrons that are used to image. And this wavelength happens to be very short. For 100 kV, I think it's 0.037 angstroms. That would mean that the resolution, theoretical resolution, is in this range. The practical resolution is much lower, unfortunately, and this is due to noise in the data, the quality of electron optics, and other things, but still the practical the actual resolution of electron microscope is easily in the range of one angstrom. So this is what people use in material science, for example, when they study semiconductors, and it's not unusual to collect data at one angstrom. Still, in electron microscopy, what we are getting is much less than that. And what is the reason for it? Well, the reasons are that we are working with biological material. So first, we have radiation damage, so we have to limit the exposure, which means that signal-to-noise ratio is very poor. Second factor, which is equally damaging, which is that in order to improve signal-to-noise ratio in the data, we have to align our images and average them. And this process is really bad because it ruins our statistical reasoning. Our images are no longer independent, and accuracy of the alignment has adverse impact on the resolution, but it's very difficult to assess it. In a sense, we cannot perform this experiment anymore that I described here. I cannot put two gold particles and image them and decide that this is my resolution, because although in fact it is a resolution, in practice I start moving my images, start aligning them, and that ruins this simple relation. In tomography, that is done this way because we use gold particles to align tomographic data, but then still the error that is measured, the error of or accuracy of alignment of gold particles is very high. If one would consider this to be a resolution, that would be a very optimistic measure. The actual resolution is much less, and it's difficult to measure. So this puts these thoughts together, this slide, and here I'm trying to argue that the concept of optical resolution is not really applicable to electron microscopy for all the reasons that I already discussed to an extent. So the main problem is that we don't really have an external standard by which we could measure the resolution. Well, this is not entirely true, because if I were persistent and solved my structure to, say, 2-3 angstroms, I would see at certain point secondary structure. Yes, I would see helices, and then I could apply this reasoning, which is borrowed from optics, in a sense, by simply observing details of atomic structure, I could assess what the resolution is. Unfortunately, for vast majority of our structures, that is not the case, because our resolution, we see it, is limited to 10, 20 angstroms, and that means I have nothing to compare it with. So the only way to approach the the assessment of the resolution is start looking at the consistency of the data, because I don't really have any external standards. And this is what I'm trying to say. So in electron microscopy, we shift our thinking, and instead of talking about optical resolution, we start talking about internal consistency of the data. How well does it agree with each other? Right? What it also means that unless we have these external standards, unless I can see secondary structure, all what I will say from now on is purely subjective, because this is something what I think about the resolution, but other people are free to think about it differently. So historically, has been a lot of work done on this assessment of self-consistency of the results in electron microscopy. Some of these concepts were borrowed from X-ray crystallography and adopted to electron microscopy. But basically, all these measures try to estimate how the data agrees with itself. The most commonly used measures are Fourier ring correlation. There is also differential phase residual and spectral signal to noise ratio. There is also a Q factor, but it has slightly strange statistical properties, so I will not talk about this one. Differential phase residual is a very nice measure, but again, it's difficult to assess its statistical properties, so I sort of gave up working on this one. As far as Fourier ring correlation is concerned, now you should start seeing connections with what I was saying at the beginning. Since this happens to be a correlation coefficient, it is directly related to signal-to-noise ratio, and these two measures, as I will argue in a moment, are equivalent, or they express the same properties, reflect the same properties of the data. So Fourier ring correlation. Well, this is a definition of the correlation coefficient which you saw before. The only difference now is that it's calculated in Fourier space. That doesn't really matter. What I have here is our Fourier transform of two images, and I will do the product, sum, and divide by normalize by the power. Now, in order to evaluate quality of the result, I will perform this calculation not for the whole image in the Fourier space, but I will do it within rings. So for each ring in the image, I will perform this summation independently, and in effect, I will obtain a set of numbers as a function of radius in Fourier space, and in effect, I will obtain a curve. The same can be done in real space, but let's not confuse it at this point. All right? So Fourier ring correlation is nothing else but a correlation coefficient calculated in Fourier space, and it's calculated within rings or in three-dimensional space within shells and yields a curve. So it's no longer a single number. Instead, it's a set of correlation coefficients calculated as a function of Fourier frequency. So now, how do we do it in practice? Because we have just one 3D reconstruction or one average. So the trick is that we can split randomly our data set into halves. Yes, so we have 100 images. We will align them and take 50 here, 50 there, calculate two averages, calculate their Fourier transforms. This is F and G, and calculate this. Okay, so that's a very good measure, and I will show you in a moment what are the properties of it. Now, the danger of it is that these two images, these two averages, because they were aligned, they were derived from the same data set that went through the same alignment process, are not truly independent, and this will validate the assumptions behind this equation. So if I want to hide this dependence, what I would do is that I would perform the alignment independently, entirely independently. start independently, do that, and then compare these two averages obtained from two alignments. The difficulty with this is that usually it's not that easy to calculate, to perform two alignments entirely independently, because as you heard already many times, we have to start from some kind of reference images. Yes, so there is always something that these two data sets will share. Nevertheless, this is a better way of assessing resolution than the first one. Yes. Okay, so let me keep going. So this slide again shows how that is done. Two Fourier transforms. I have a ring. I will take points from each of these rings. You go through this equation and obtain a curve. And this is a typical Fourier shell correlation curve. Now, at this point, you should start seeing how that relates to assessment of self-consistency of the data, because I have relation between correlation coefficient and the signal-to-noise ratio in the data. Yes. So by looking at this curve, I can calculate easily what is the signal-to-noise ratio for a given frequency. And then I can agree with myself that as soon as the signal-to-noise ratio falls below certain value, which is entirely arbitrary, I will consider this a limiting resolution beyond which the noise starts dominating the data. What this value is, I will discuss in a moment. So, obvious question is, why does it work? Yes? So, as I was saying, it works because this correlation coefficient yields a value of spectral, because it's in Fourier space, signal-to-noise ratio in the reconstruction. And it also so happens that Fourier shell correlation is directly related to alignment errors in the data. So far, I was only discussing the problem of how to assess the noise level in the data. But as we certainly know, we have another source of errors, which are alignment errors. And both have an impact on Fourier shell correlation curves. And fortunately, this impact is somewhat complicated and not easy to express. So this is, look, maybe might be looking a little bit busy, but here we were wondering how indeed alignment errors how they are related to the shape of Fourier shell correlation curves, and this is drawn from our recent work. This is work by Phil Baldwin in my group. So then it turns out that when we introduce translational error into the data set, the Fourier ring correlation curve will start decreasing in high frequencies, and it decreases more for larger alignment errors. And this is what we would want to have, and this is a very nice feature. The problem is that this behavior is not true. It's not identical for rotational errors. And this was rather disappointing fact after we realized it. The reason is that Fourier shell correlation curve is calculated based on 2D Fourier transform in Cartesian coordinates. Without being too abstract, it so happens that translation is very easily expressed by two-dimensional Fourier transforms in Cartesian coordinates. But it's not well expressed, but the rotational error is not well expressed, and therefore it's not reflected in a simple manner by Fourier shell correlation curves. So this is depicted here on the vertical axis. If we increase rotational misalignment, these curves do not fall off the same way as the curves obtained for translational error, but they are simply are getting more and more weird and more noisy. So this is a problem, and it's good to be aware of it. What we are trying to do now and implement in this new software that I told you about yesterday, Phil derived a method which allows one to decompose these two curves and measure from the aligned data set the amount of translational and rotational error independently, which then can help us to improve the alignment by focusing on one of these effects, one of the problems. So now, how the spectral signal-to-noise ratio looks like and how to calculate it. Well, in 2D, it's quite simple. We would calculate Fourier transforms of our images, yes? So we have a stack of 2D Fourier transforms. And then for each pixel, we can calculate the average value, and we can calculate the variance in Fourier space. It works exactly the same way as in real space. And now we can say, okay, in Fourier space, the average is my signal, the variance is my error, and simply I can calculate the ratio of these two quantities, and that happens to be signal-to-noise ratio. Now, if I do that, and again do the same trick, that I will do it within rings and calculate many of these numbers for various frequencies, I will obtain this kind of plot, yes? Now, unlike in Fourier shell correlation, it's not limited to the value of 1, because signal-to-noise ratio, as I said, in the absence of noise is infinite. Instead, I will obtain this rapidly decreasing curve. But as I said, there is really no new information here because of this relation between signal-to-noise ratio and Fourier shell correlation. So what I have now are two different ways of obtaining the same information, which is a measure of signal-to-noise ratio in the data. All right, so now what about our agreement? What should we consider a reasonable level of signal in the data, yes? So normally we will obtain this kind of curve, yes, which is slowly decreasing. This is our Fourier shell correlation curve. It can be easily calculated what is the signal-to-noise ratio, and we can start worrying about a single number that we would want to report. So my thinking is that a reasonable criterion would be to consider my resolution to be a point at which signal is still higher than the noise. If I were to filter this data, I would probably reject frequencies beyond which noise is higher than noise is higher than signal. So it appears to me that reasonable criterion is to report resolution as a spatial frequency at which signal-to-noise ratio drops below 1. And again, using this simple equation, I can calculate that this happens to be 0.333. Why is it not 0.5 that you occasionally see? Well, it has a long history, but very briefly, the problem is that when we calculate this curve, we split the data set into halves, yes? So when I calculate Fourier shell correlation curve, and then derive signal-to-noise ratio from it, it reflects signal-to-noise ratio in half of the data set because I split it, yes? So then by using simple reasoning, what it would be if I could somehow calculate it for the whole data set? Well, obviously it will be twice as much because I have twice as many images. That's why I inserted this number 2 here. In a sense, if I calculate Fourier shell correlation using this prescription by splitting data set into halves, then in order to get signal-to-noise ratio, I have to use this equation and, in addition, multiply it by 2. Another criterion would be based on the statistical reasoning that I described. In a sense, well, let's assume then I would set the resolution at a point at which correlation coefficient is significantly higher than 0. Okay? Well, what does it mean, significantly? This is the point exactly where we get into troubles, because this number is entirely arbitrary and it's reflected, is related to this significance level. So there were many different criteria used, 2 sigma, 3 sigma. Currently, the most commonly used is 3 sigma, which means I will include Fourier information that is significantly higher than 0, and my significance level is 3 sigma. If you remember, this is about 2%. All right? What is the problem with all these criteria? I will say in a moment. There is another thing that I can use Fourier shell correlation for, which is what we term a cross-resolution. Yes? Because obviously, if I know what my structure is, or if I have X-ray crystallographic structure, which is here on the right, and here I have an EM map, I can calculate Fourier shell correlation between the two, and that will give me, should give me a measure of how good my EM map is, assuming that it is, in principle, identical to X-ray crystallographic map. Now, intuitively, again, it should be clear that the cutoff level should be different than the one that I had when I compared two noisy maps. And again, by going through a simple map, I can simple mass, I can derive this equation, which tells me that when I compare noise in, a map corrupted by noise with noise-free map, the signal-to-noise ratio is also related to Fourier shell correlation. But now, as you see, there are square values here. So now, if I use the criterion of resolution being related to signal-to-noise ratio equal 1, then it happens that the cutoff level should be 0.71. So all what I would want to you to remember at this point is that when I compare two maps which are corrupted by noise, the value of Fourier shell correlation that corresponds to SNR 1 is 0.333 or 1/3. If I compare X-ray map with EM map, the same, using the same reasoning, I have to use cutoff level of 0.71. Okay, so if you remember this, you're okay. All right. So now, going back to my beginning of my talk, I showed you how to calculate error bars for correlation coefficients, and I can apply this reasoning to my Fourier shell correlation curves, because for each radius in for each shell or each ring within which I calculated Fourier shell correlation, I can calculate what is the number of voxels in Fourier space that went into equation, and that gives me directly the error of the correlation coefficient. So then using this transformation, Fischer's transformation, I can convert it to a normal variable. I can add 1 or 2 sigma, I can subtract 1 or 2 sigma, I can convert it back to the value of correlation coefficient, and then I will have, as I'm showing here in red, my Fourier shell correlation curve, and blue curves are error bars. Okay? So why is it significant? Because it simply tells me at any point what this value would be within certain, within reasonable reasonable levels of regions of confidence. So here, this curve is simply this 3 sigma curve, which I calculated for each ring, assuming that correlation coefficient is 0. Yes? So these are two different tests that can be done. And as you see, for Fourier shell correlation curve that goes to 0, these two curves agree, obviously, because for a correlation coefficient 0, the distribution is normal. But for smaller values, yes, of for larger values of correlation coefficient, the error bars are higher and are shown here. All right. So now, given that, I can start looking at actual Fourier shell correlation curves, and this is a curve which I just pulled from somewhere. So in red, I have Fourier shell correlation curve. I know what is n, what is the number of Fourier voxels here. In this case, it also so happened that this structure had D3 symmetry. This three symmetry means that there is six-fold redundancy in Fourier space, and when one calculates these error bars, that has to be taken into account. For example, in SPIDER, in EMAN2, when Fourier shell correlation is reported, n, which is printed, is the number of all voxels in Fourier space, but this has to be corrected using a given point group symmetry. So for D3, it has to be divided by 6. In any case, that's a simple story. So Now I'm looking at my Fourier shell correlation curve, and I see that it behaves reasonably. So first it drops, and then it starts oscillating around zero. And now I look at 3 sigma criterion. The difficulty with 3 sigma criterion is exactly what we observe here, that the curve is likely to decrease below this threshold and then increase again. The reason is that these errors here are large and unpredictable. Another very significant problem is that, as always in statistics, it works very well as long as my assumptions are correct. And here, the weakness is that the number of voxels in Fourier space, which is reported, this n, in reality is much less than what program prints. The reason that it's less is that the structure is normally solved within certain region of Fourier space. In other words, there is certain masking involved. This masking, if we think about the problem in Fourier space, means that Fourier voxels are no longer statistically independent, and this number n, which is reported, is way too high. The difficulty is, if I could, I would correct it and print correct number, but the difficulty is that normally it is not known what kind of masking was applied, what other image processing operations were involved. For example, rotation of images, which involves interpolation, will also affect this number n and decrease it. So it is impossible to calculate this number accurately, and it has to be treated with certain skepticism. But because this number n is inaccurate, when I'm close to zero with my correlation coefficient, unfortunately, I'm very likely to make a mistake and report a wrong number, because, as you see, this red curve intersects my green curve in many points, and it's obviously a good question whether this is a resolution, this might be, or better yet, this one. Right? So that's why criteria that use higher values are preferable, because a chance of error is much less. Still, one that is commonly used is 0.5. Yes? The nice thing about 0.5 is that it's directly related to Fourier filters. For example, if I use this number as resolution and apply low-pass filtration, many filters will accept this value, and like say Gaussian filter, and then the shape of the filter will more or less agree with this curve. So that's a nice thing about 0.5 criterion. Still, if I use error bars, I will easily notice that I was still too optimistic, because the lower value of error is here. So although I think my correlation coefficient is 0.5, still on this 3 sigma level of confidence, it could be still much less. So if I want to be very, very sure on 3 sigma level that my correlation coefficient is 0.5, I would have to choose the location at which this light blue curve is 0.5, not the red curve. Yes, the lower error bar is above 0.5, but that would mean that my red curve is somewhere at 0.71. So the take-home message here is that there is a lot of uncertainty here what I should do, and good custom would be to look at the error bars and make sure that the resolution level, the cutoff level that I'm choosing, stays away from zero, and the error bars are relatively narrow. So far, we were trying to decide how to express resolution by one number, and it should be obvious at this point that this number is to a large extent irrelevant, because what really matters is the whole shape of the curve, and I will show you examples later. The reason that the shape of the curve matters is that after the reconstruction is performed, after the analysis is finished, one would want to apply low-pass filtration in order to eliminate noise from the reconstruction and increase signal-to-noise ratio in real space. So now the obvious question is what this filter should be and how is it related to Fourier shell correlation curve. And then it turns out that there is a very simple relation. We already heard about Wiener filtration. And indeed, using similar reasoning as we apply to derivation of CTF correction, we can derive an optimum filter and realize that it's related to signal-to-noise ratio in the data. So given Fourier shell correlation curve, I can calculate signal-to-noise ratio as a function of frequency and use this equation, and this is my filter. So this is raw reconstruction, and this is properly filtered image. And now if you go back and compare it with this equation, yes, you realize that this is nothing else but my Fourier shell correlation. It's getting a little bit complicated because of this number 2. Nevertheless, the proper filter looks like that. So approximately, one can think about it in very simple terms, that the proper filtration is nothing else but multiplication of the original image by the Fourier shell correlation curve itself. All right? So this is something... Yes. So that is something that relates Fourier shell correlation curve to filtration and indicates that the resolution is in fact expressed by the whole curve, not by a single number. So now, what are the known problems associated with Fourier shell correlation? I already discussed number of independent voxels in Fourier space. We don't know how much is that, and there are many things that will affect it, and some of them are known cheats. People who are really driven to report a very good resolution, meaning a very low number, will occasionally resort to desperation, and these are things that are better avoided. For example, masking in real space. That is known to improve the resolution dramatically. Even if the mask doesn't really cut into the structure, by designing a mask that has a very complicated shape, has many bumps and cavities, I can very significantly improve the resolution. The reason is that Fourier shell correlation compares two images, and now even if they are not very similar, they will share the same shape of the mask, and the resolution will improve. In general, Fourier shell correlation depends on the window size. Again, a simple cheat is after I'm done with the reconstruction, I can window the structure. Reduce the window size from, say, 128 to 96. Again, the resolution will improve dramatically. What is often overlooked is the fact that the number of voxels depends on the symmetry, and this is not currently reported by the software because, at least in SPIDER, there is no connection between calculation of Fourier shell correlation and the symmetry. It just doesn't enter this process. So one just has to remember it and divide the number which is printed by the multiplicity given by the symmetry. All right? So how to fight these problems? Well, first, we normally oversample our data. The reason is that interpolation affects mainly very high frequencies. If I work with the image which is sampled, as we would say, properly at Nyquist frequencies, these high frequencies will become all correlated due to image processing steps, which are 3D reconstruction and rotation, and will create artificial agreements between images. So obviously, we would want to oversample. Concerning masking, the answer is simple. Do not mask. Adjust box size and stay with it. In a sense, if we start manipulating box size, the resolution curves will start changing, and it's very hard to say which resolution is a true one. And also, as I was saying, it's preferable to use higher cutoff level because the chance of making a mistake is less. Another problem, which is not that easy to realize, it's something which was already discussed to an extent, which is in many projects, the protein will have a strongly preferred orientation, meaning there will be certain projections which are plentiful and some other I will have very few. So you have a direction at which I have very large number of projections, the reported resolution will be dominated by the resolution of this one direction. That is a very sad fact, which is not well understood, not appreciated sufficiently. Resolution curves are dominated by directions along which I have many, many projections. What happens is that I solve the structure, it doesn't look like much, it has clear streaks due to these overabundant projections, but the resolution curve will look very, very nice, because in effect all what is telling me is that the resolution in this one direction is very good, and the rest is not included. Okay, so this is what I'm trying to say here. The answer to it is in one of my earlier papers. One can calculate distribution of signal-to-noise ratio in 3D, voxel by voxel, in Fourier space, and there we have tools that can plot this distribution of 3D SSNR as an isosurface in 3D Fourier space, or space of signal-to-noise ratio, and one would have a look at it and easily notice whether the signal-to-noise ratio is spherical, as it should be, or, say, elliptical, which would be very bad. We also heard many times about alignment of noise, and there is no good answer to it, in a sense, because we have to do alignment, it will affect our resolution curve and will make them look better than they should. Finally, Fourier shell correlation is not applicable to cases when number of projections is small, and that is mainly tomography, and there are no good resolution measures for tomography. So now I have a small number of examples of resolution curves, and I will end with that. So that's an example of a healthy resolution curve, and that's how it should look like in general. In a sense, it should start from 1, then it should slowly decrease in this semi-Gaussian manner. The reason it should decrease this way is that any actual image, real image that we look at, will have decreasing power spectrum. It's a fact of life. Images are dominated by low frequencies, high frequencies are weaker. Well, it also means that normally, alignment will be more accurate in low frequencies than in high frequencies. So unless I did something very, very strange, the alignment error should increase with high frequencies, and that's why I have this small, slow fall-off. Finally, it should drop to 0 and then oscillate around 0. Well, it means that it oscillates around 0, that there is no signal anymore, and this is just random fluctuation due to noise. So one of the things to pay attention to, if the curve never goes below 0 and oscillates, say, around 0.1, that's a strong indication that the noise was aligned. Also, another artifact which I say here, because we oversampled our data, the curve should be at 0, somewhere around 2/3 of the maximum frequency. The rest of Fourier space is suspicious, and the curve better be 0. If the data was undersampled and the resolution curve extends all the way to maximum frequency, that means that there are artifacts. So one of the, unfortunately, often encountered resolution curves is something that is almost exactly 1, and it has this box shape. In a sense, it drops rapidly to 0 at certain point. I call it rectangular. Okay, what it indicates normally, that alignment procedures were not applied properly, and there was some kind of filtration involved in it, either enhancement or truncation. And in general, this result is fake. Moreover, if the resolution curve has this rectangular shape, it will also create, it means that in Fourier, in real space, the image will have ripple-like artifacts at the edges. And that is a very bad thing. So whenever you see curve like that, one, I would recommend checking whether somebody low-pass filtered the data. That means that there is really no information there. Or maybe during alignment, there was some kind of high-pass filters applied, which enhanced this frequency and then dropped to zero. Yes? This is another problem, which is occasionally observed. It never drops to zero. It never drops even below 0.5. Okay, so this is normally, this will normally emerge when noise is aligned. Again, by running alignment on and on, applying high pass filtration and trying to get good resolution in the structure, I'm running a danger of overdoing it and then aligning the noise. And what will happen is that information all the way to Nyquist frequency correlates, but the result is obviously fake. In rare cases, it could also mean that, in principle, it could be correct because the data was severely undersampled and the pixel size is very large. Say, I work on an intermediate resolution structure, but I made a mistake and I chose pixel size to be 6 angstroms. Yes, that would correspond to maximum frequency 12 angstroms, and if my structure, if indeed I have an information in the data somewhere to 10 angstroms, it means the resolution curve will look beautifully, but because of these problems of interpolation in Fourier space, these high frequencies are unreliable, and unfortunately there is no simple solution to it, no better solution than going back to original micrographs, resampling them using smaller pixel size, and repeating the analysis. That's another problem here that is occasionally encountered. So initially it behaves well, and then it goes up again. Not only it's difficult to say what the resolution is, but that indicates serious problems. So one possibility is that there was only one defocus group, yes, and this is simply a zero of the transfer function. What it could also mean is that the data was low-pass filtered at certain point. And what happens is, in Fourier space, I have zeros in high frequencies. Then, I of course doubt that you still remember the equation for Fourier shell correlation, but what you have there is a division of Fourier components. If they were set to zero, the computer will have to divide zero by zero, and the result, I don't know what it is, but it can look like that. What I also observed, that it's easy to make a mistake which will produce a curve like this. For example, if I rotate all images by the same angle, say 37 degrees, what it will cause, it will introduce the same interpolation in the stack of images. Yes? Then I calculate Fourier shell correlation, and they all strangely agree, because what I injected is this interpolation error. All right? Another problem, the curve oscillates around 0.5. Okay? So, for example, what it can mean is that the data is dominated by an electron microscopy session, which was all done using the same defocus value. And again, this simply reflects the contrast transfer function. So this is not necessarily wrong, the resolution curve, but again, the fact that in Fourier space, I have this sharp curve will result in rippling artifacts in real space. Moreover, it's not very clear what the resolution is and how to filter the structure. Okay, so I guess I will stop at this point. I think that I managed to persuade you that a choice of a single number, although convenient when we talk to each other, doesn't say very much, and the only way to really communicate what is the quality of the structure is to show the resolution curve, not necessarily in the paper, but at least to have it around and compare with other results. In general, if I have to report one number, it better not be zero, because then I run a very severe risk of making a mistake. If I report resolution as a point at which Fourier shell correlation drops to zero, the risk of making a mistake is very high, so it's better to use a higher higher cutoff. Finally, I showed how to calculate these confidence intervals. They are currently not implemented in SPIDER, not in IMAN2, but if we believe that they are valuable, I can easily add them. So that will be it. Thank you.
Thank you, Pavel. I think it was an excellent talk.
Thank you.
Introducing this. Other questions?
Yes. Not anymore. That used to be, say, required by reviewers, but not anymore. It just takes space. I mean, you know, it's sort of a gentleman's agreement. I trust you that your curve is okay. And as I'm saying, if you have it around, or I saw it on the poster, that's okay. But I don't think that there is much need to put it in the paper. You know, it takes half a page from the paper.
Some of the journals allow supplementary.
Oh, that's another good thing. Yeah, I would put it there, definitely.
I mean, if you have structures which are drawn,
yeah.
Could we use this to judge the next step?
No, because, as I'm saying, there are so many possibilities to improve the resolution. And they will not be, these artifacts will not be reflected by Fourier shell correlation curve. That is pointless. Yes. Yes. So the question is, if the particle has preferred orientation, what to do? In my view, the only way to approach it is to, unfortunately, reject the data. After you did a couple of steps of alignment, you should check the distribution of projections and then eliminate those that are overabundant. Because even if you apply proper filtration, it still remains true that in Fourier space, signal-to-noise ratio along the appropriate plane will be much higher than along other directions. In effect, what will happen is that during the subsequent alignment, noisy projections will tend to be assigned to the direction which has a very high signal-to-noise ratio, whether they are similar or not. So this artifact will perpetuate itself. And unfortunately, the only way that I know how to deal with it is to lower signal-to-noise ratio in this direction by rejecting excessive number of projections, which is sort of silly, and probably many people would not agree with it because it's a waste. It's perfectly good data, but unfortunately the influence on the alignment procedure is very bad. And also, in many cases, even with proper filtration, you will have streaks in structure, which tend to look like alpha helices. And then rejoice, rejoice, you have atomic resolution, which is all an artifact of this excessive amount of data in one direction. Yes. Here. Yes. Well, something is wrong. Normally that means I would assume that you're dominated by one defocus group. We used to print these curves. I think that the last time we did it with Joachim was in 98, Malhotra et al. And then you have a complex of curves for each defocus group separately, and then how do they look like after we merged all the volumes, okay? So then when you look at individual curves from single defocus group, you will see this effect, yes, that the curve goes down. This is the zero of the transfer function, then goes up and goes down, sometimes has a number of maxima, sometimes just one. Yes. The problem with what we do is that there are endless possibilities to make a mistake somewhere. I'm not saying that it is your case necessarily, but you have to check the data very carefully, because that indicates that something is wrong. I would start from plotting all these CTFs. They can be easily generated, in Spider. So you use the focus values that you assign to your micrographs. You plot all these curves, yes? And then, very often, even though you think that your defocus values are spread, it so happens by sheer coincidence that they all have zero in the same location. Yes? So, again, you keep processing the data, you think that you covered nicely Fourier space, but in fact, they will have all minimum at certain point, and that will cause the resolution curve to drop in this location. Again, there is no good solution to it, short of going back to the microscope and collecting more data, now using one defocus setting, such that the CTF will have a maximum in this value, and you will cover this gap. Yes.
For example, where you have some X-ray data, a crystal structure, you want some X-rays, you will show them. It's a very expensive thing. You might call the X-ray structure, for say, suppression 2, and then introducing various kinds of errors into the Fourier structure.
Yes, so I agree, and I think that in some cases that was done, but it can be done, in my view, effectively only for structures that have reasonably high resolution. Yes, if EM map is at 25 angstroms, there is really nothing to compare.
But as a one-time experiment to see how the various errors.
Yes.
I
know what you mean. The problem is that once EM maps have higher resolution, it's not entirely clear that EM map is exactly the same as the X-ray map. Many EM structures will differ significantly from their X-ray counterparts. And this seems to be the case, for example, with the ribosome. As EM maps improve, they don't become more similar necessarily to X-ray structures of the ribosome. With Groyel, I'm not so sure. Probably Groyel is much closer to X-ray map or not. No, so...
It gets better to a point and then...
Yes, yes. So I think that everybody encountered this problem. You put a lot of effort into improving EM map, but at a certain point, it's not getting any closer to the X-ray map, so the comparison cannot be done.
We have time for one more question, I think. In your paper about estimating image alignments,
yes.
Errors in alignments,
yes.
You mentioned it might be possible to estimate the error for each individual image. Have you made any kind of developments?
No, we didn't finish it yet. We're working on it. So that was just the first step to see how these curves relate to alignment errors. Because even this relation was not that clear to us, and as you see, there is no simple relation, and as you probably notice in the paper, one has to calculate these Fourier ring correlations or whatever quality measure using the compositions in Cartesian space and using polar coordinates independently. But for individual images, again, I doubt that can be done, really, because unless you can see the image, actual image, and its features, then how would you verify what the error is?
Yeah,